everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had a life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my buddy, my pal, Dean Spunt of the band No Age, part of our two-episode No Age Spectacular, coming at you in a lot of glory. This is an incredible episode. You know, of course, Dean is in No Age, and we talk about that. More on all this in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Not this week, but he books a lot, most of these guests. And he will get the message to me, and I will be able to converse that way. Or you can find me on various forms of social media, at Left for Damien. There's also a Turnedoutapunk Facebook page and a Instagram page. Both of those are at Turned Out of Punk, so you can find out more information there as well. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends, letting them know that you listen to this thing and say it's a fun time. They talk about punk and bands like Chopping Block and the like. You can also support the show by heading over to the Patreon page. There's a Patreon page that we do Turned Out of Punk footnotes on and some other fun stuff, so go check that out over there. Or subscribe to this thing, rate it on your platform listening to of choice. Speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support of the fine folks of Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, do what you do, just don't lose money doing it. So we're going to help you do that, and I really appreciate them doing that as well. You know, between them and the Patreon people, I really can't thank you both enough for your support and everything on the show. All right, moving on to today's show. I'm burning through these episodes. I got so many in the backlog, and I got more people coming on. Oh my gosh, I just got off doing a record breaking. I think it's going to be the record for the longest episode ever, a part two with someone. And oh man, so I apologize if I'm a little marble mouthed. I've been talking a lot. And I will now continue to talk more because I got to talk about my friends No Age and their brand new album, Goons Be Gone. You think I'm plugging it like I'm being paid to do it? No, I love this band, and this is a fantastic new album. And when it was coming out, I reached out to these guys and said, hey, please come back on the show and we can talk about it because come back on the show. I feel like I've had them on the show before because I this is a band that I really feel like I should have had on the show prior to. They are... you know, as I say, a band that meant a lot to me, not just as musicians that I like, but as just on a personal level, touring with them and stuff at a very kind of key moment in my own life and fucked up, to bring it back to myself as egotistically as possible. But truthfully, you know, and we had mutual road crew, shout out to Bram, and we had, you know, a lot of mutual kind of ideals, you know, just politics and personal beliefs and things like that. But also, you know, Dean was straight edge at the time that I was straight edge. And then, you know, we talk about this stuff in a second on the show. So that's it. I'm not going to blather on anymore. Check out Goons Be Gone. Check out the other episode with Randy Randall as well. Kind of amazing little bookends right here. Anyway, I'm not going to blather on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Dean Spunt on Turned Out a Punk. Dean, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes. What's up? Very excited.
I'm beside myself excited to have you on. I want to have you on literally for years, and I want to do this in person because I feel like a strong sort of kinship with you, being that I met you when you were straight edge, and then you broke straight edge first, and I followed your lead a few years later. So I feel like, you know, I've walked your path a little bit behind you.
So. I've since returned back to pretty close to being straight edge. But
well, maybe that's happened to me in a few more years.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. But anyway, dude, it's so great to talk to you again.
Yeah, man. It's really good to hear from you. I'm psyched to get to finally do this. I've been wondering when you're going to ask me to do this thing.
Well, yeah, like it's funny because there's people that I'm just like, oh, like, you know, yeah, sure, we can do this on the phone. But then there's people I'm like, oh, I want to save it so we can do it in person. And then, you know, now that we're never going to see anyone else ever again, we might as well do it here.
Yeah.
But Dean, I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah. I've been thinking about this, and really, it starts with the most generic answer you can give is that I heard a Ramones tape, and it was I must have been in fifth grade or so. And a friend of mine, we were getting into skateboarding. His older brother was into punk rock. You know, I vaguely knew what that was because I was a punk rocker when I was in third grade. A couple years before, for Halloween, I dressed up as a punk rocker. So I had these felt wristbands and a felt black felt vest that my mom made with little studs on it, and I had a Rolling Stones t-shirt, like a black Rolling Stones t-shirt with the mouth logo that my mom must have had or something. To me, that was punk rock. I had no idea. I was a child, little child, and I had a flat top, and they sprayed my hair with different colors. But I heard this Ramones tape. A friend of ours, older brother, was into punk, and he let us borrow a tape, or we stole it. I don't remember exactly, but I do remember listening to it, and it was the first record, and it was on a cassette, and it had the image of that first album cover where they're against the wall, black and white. And I listened to it over and over, and I was so intrigued by it, and it was almost a scary thing to me. Like I couldn't understand what was happening, but I loved it. And it felt scary in a way.
And what kind of stuff were you into prior to that? Like, you know, you mentioned being dressed up as a punk rocker, but like, you know, musically, I'm sure it wasn't, you know, punk rock by that point, before that.
No, I mean, well, shit, like MC Hammer or something.
Yeah.
But I think that right around when I found out about punk or what it was, Nirvana was also happening.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a coalesce of those two things at the same time. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I really, I had an older cousin who was into hip hop. So I think right before punk, like DJ Quick and NWA, and like, I knew about that from my cousin. I'd hear it and listen to it and thought it was cool. Those things kind of all happened around the same time, but definitely punk piqued my interest most. And then through another friend we were skateboarding with, his older brother had his Ed Kennedy's tape and like Eye Against Eye. This all happened before I'm in middle school. So this is like fifth, sixth grade. I'm just like, I got all of these tapes and I would listen to them, borrow them, and sort of put the pieces together. And then I had another interesting thing happen, I think, the next year when I was in junior high. I'll tell this story quick because I think it makes sense in the trajectory of my music. But my aunt's boyfriend was from Oxnard, and she was living with us, with me and my family at the time. Her boyfriend was from Oxnard, and my aunt told him that I was getting into punk music. This is, shit, I must have been like 11 or somewhere around 10, 11, 12. I can't remember exactly, but but he gave me two cassette tapes. He's like, oh, yeah, your aunt said you're into punk. I want to give you these tapes. One said, it was a mixtape, and it had this sort of, on the side of the tape, it said Skins Oi Oi Oi.
Yeah.
And I had just learned what a skinhead was, too. And I thought it was only a Nazi thing.
You know?
I listened to this tape, and it had Cockney Rejects on it, and it had like Dr. No. It had a lot of Nardcore stuff on it because he was from Oxnard, I guess. It had Adolescence on it, and I listened to this tape, and I was really, really into it. But then I started getting worried because the way he wrote it on the tape, his stylized writing, like the E, was just three lines, didn't have the vertical line up and down.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Like the skate logo, the skate way of writing an E almost.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it's very stylized. The S's were really, you know, like pointy and everything in it. It was really cool looking. It said Skins on it all over the place. And the Adolescence, it almost, I thought it said Adolf Sense.
Yeah, yep.
And I grew up, my dad was Jewish, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, really freaked out for, I was like, oh my God, this is Nazi music.
Yeah. Well, especially,
but I also liked it. I couldn't figure it out. So there's a local record store. I went there and I asked the kid at the record shop and I said, hey, do you have, it took me a lot of courage to get in there and ask. I'm like, do you have a band called the Adolf Sense? And the dude, you know, the dude's probably in high school, maybe older. And he's like, what? I'm like, Adolf Sense. And I think I said one of the songs. They have a song, you know, Amoeba. The guy's like, oh, Adolescence. And I think I said, well, yeah. And he showed me the album cover and I was so relieved. I was like, fuck yeah.
Yes. Yes. Oh, thank you.
So anyway, I that was another pivotal sort of this mixtape and the early tapes. They led me to a path.
Did you ever talk to that guy about going to shows or anything? Like, was he like a hardcore kid type thing?
No, because he gave me the tapes. I ingested them. And then by the time I did, he was out of the picture.
Okay.
But the vivid memory I remember is that he might have been a skinhead. Because all, you know, before I knew what that was, I remember him wearing like really tight 501s.
Yeah.
You know, and in my mind at that age, I just associated that with being a cowboy.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but years later, when I learned more about skinhead culture, it made sense that, oh, he was probably, you know, ex skinhead or something. Or
yeah.
Yeah. Like who else wears tight 501s?
You know, cowboys.
Not in like the mid 90s.
Not in the mid 90s. No, definitely not. It was
a weird baggy pants.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like every normal person would at that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where did you kind of go from getting these tapes though? Like, had you gone to any concerts before this or anything?
Well, the first concert I ever went to was at Magic Mountain, Six Flags.
Yeah.
I was really young, still in elementary school, and I saw Luther Vandross.
That's a good first show.
Oh, dude. Yeah. That was pretty wild. I think it was Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, maybe, and Luther Vandross.
What
a weird bill, you know. They would put these really fucked up bills together. Now that I play music and play festivals, I'm sure it was a high price tag for them. And I barely remember that, but I do remember putting on out like a big. We had a lot of clothes at my house. My mom like would pile all these. There's just like rooms and rooms because they also ran a silkscreen shop, so there's just clothes everywhere, shirts and stuff. So I like put on this giant jacket. I vaguely remember this, but
yeah,
I just thought it was a cool look or something, you know, maybe. Anyway, that was at Six Flags. Barely, that was my first concert. But the first time I went to a show, I was in junior high. Yeah, I was about seventh grade. And there was a local punk show that I got a flyer for at my junior high. And there's a band called The Outside. I think they're kind of, I feel like it was a pop punk band, but I can't really remember. And it was at the VFW hall, and my dad dropped me off before he went to his NA, his Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And he's like, hey, I'm gonna drop you off here. I'll pick you up in like an hour and a half. Cool. And I went in and it just felt like a blur. I just saw people. I saw people jumping around. I saw people playing. But I already knew, you know, I had some tapes. I knew about punk a bit and I loved it.
Did you like know about this band? Like, how'd you hear about the show even happening?
Just a flyer. Someone gave me a flyer at our junior high. Yeah. Like someone was passing out flyers. Maybe. Oh yeah. I think it was a friend's, someone that went to school's brother was in one of the bands. And then the next year, yeah, I went to another show. Another band from my high school was playing a show in Hollywood this time. The first show is in this little town I grew up in called Saugus. And then the second show I went to was, in Hollywood at this place called the Natural Fudge Cafe.
What a name.
Yeah. Remember it smelled like urine and they were selling hot dogs and, it was me and like six other little skateboard kids. We went, I think that one of the dads dropped us off and we were totally out of our element. And yeah, two bands from our high school played, and then this band from San Diego called the Spent Idols.
Oh shit! Did they put out records?
Yeah, they were like you know, they had Mohawks and yeah, like Liberty Spikes. They were kind of a 77 type band.
Yeah, totally. I think I know that. I think I have a 7-inch.
Yeah. Yeah. They played with the like high school band, and this is crazy actually. So we're like 12 years old, and the guy from the Spent Idols got in an argument with the band from our high school, which are older kids. These kids are probably juniors or seniors, and we were just freshmen. They got in some argument, and the Spent Idols guy pulled a gun on the what was the corporate condo is the local band. So they played. So another one of the older kids rushed all of us younger kids into the one of the vans. Like, you guys stay here. Some guy pulled a gun. Shit's going down, and I was freaked out, but also like, fuck yeah, punk. This is what I want. This is amazing. What's going on?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That is that's like, how many people were at that show even? Like, was it four?
I don't even remember. I remember standing in the back, and, oh, there was another band that played called Phil's Throne.
Okay.
Which, do you know Brian Rotinger? He used to do our graphic design stuff, and,
I think I met him with you guys.
You've met Brian. And then, Aaron, who was in the Liars. So they're from Santa Clarita. They're from where I grew up too.
Yeah.
I didn't know them then, but they were skateboarder guys. They were in this band that were, I think they sounded more like, in my memory, like FYP.
Yeah.
Just kind of fast and trashy. But yeah, Brian might have taken his pants off and thrown a pumpkin in the audience. It was all very chaotic and anarchic.
So were there like a lot of kids in your high school that were kind of getting into this stuff at the same time?
Not really. There was the older kids that were, there's a couple bands. Yeah. And then in my age group, like just getting into high school, I had a few friends that were into punk, but not as much as me. You know, I got really, really into it. Like, I dropped skateboarding and just was into music and just into, you know, I'd show my friends like this. And I think I could tell their interest was waning. Mm-hmm. And where I grew up was kind of there was no radio station, you know, there was no college station. The college out there was a community college, and then CalArts, a really wild art college. And there was really nowhere to find information. There was a small record store that had some stuff, and that's where I asked about that Adolescence album. But it was hard. Mm-hmm. It was hard to find out what was going on.
Would you get like K-Rock and those types of radio stations out there?
Yeah. K-Rock and like, an oldies station, and then I think some, you know, country music.
Like, how much sort of penetration would, like, I guess it's even probably a few years before this stuff would really start exploding, but like, would like bands like Pennywise and Strung Out have on like K-Rock? Like, would they play those types of bands at all?
You know, I don't even think I got K-Rock where I live. Mm-hmm. I think it's when you drive out of town, you'd hear it.
Okay. Yeah, totally.
So I think those bands were popular when I was in junior high. Yeah, I had Pennywise and Strung Out and NoFX. I mean, that was definitely one avenue of entry that I explored, and then it became not that interesting.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like around high school time, you could tell like the kind of the jockey guys were into that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wrote that off as not being, I don't know, anything that I'd like anymore. Although I do, I mean, pop punk in its like simplest and dumbest form, like Screeching Weasel or the Queers, like I'm forever a fan of that kind of music.
Well, yeah. Like, where'd you kind of go? Like, you mentioned getting deeper into it. Like, what kind of stuff were you getting into? Was it that kind of Lookout Records sound?
I that was sort of a younger junior high thing. I liked that. And then right around high school, I started getting into, you know, I got into being straight edge, so then I learned about more hardcore stuff. But I really dug my teeth into Discord.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that was the first sort of that, simultaneously with Black Flag and SST. Like, the maybe they're both labels, and that's something I haven't really thought about too much. But those, I think Straight Edge, Minor Threat, and then Discord, and just trying to like learn everything about Discord. And, you know, I'd mail order stuff whenever I'd get any money, and Discord was cool because it wasn't wasn't a genre. You know, it wasn't, it just sort of felt like I'd order a Faith Void and I'd get it. I'm like, this is amazing. I do like this kind of music. And then I'd order Ignition or something and I'd get it and be like, I don't not get this, but it has the guy from the other band, the guy from Faith, and the other guy I like. And so I always felt like I would get it. I got something. I knew I wasn't there yet, but I knew it was important, you know?
Yeah. It's almost come up like a lot on the show now where it's the idea, I guess, that like, you know, you had to pick because there's limited resources. You couldn't buy everything. So you kind of had to go with like what you trusted. So if you found a label with like a couple bands on it that you liked, you'd be like, well, just buy stuff on this label because it's safe to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least I knew there was, it felt substantial, even though, like I said, musically, maybe, you know, Fire Party, like, I'm still waiting for that one to click.
To click. And,
a lot of those records I still have. I haven't gotten rid of them because I'm like, I mean, now it's like historical at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was also their dedication to fostering this community of people that were making art and no matter what. That's why I like about SST too. It felt like there was a lineage and you could trace it back and you could say, oh, this guy was in this band, this person was in this band, this woman played in this band. And the music maybe isn't my style now, but, you know, who knows?
It was also, there's like almost like philosophies that went along with these labels. So like, as you're saying, like, you know, the Epitaph Fat Record stuff, because it was being taken up by the jocks around you, like, didn't connect at all. But like, you know, the Discord, there's like a philosophy to it. And same with SST, you know, different philosophies, but still philosophies to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they felt tangible. And I don't know if I really realized SST was, you know, a local label even. Mm-hmm. Like Discord felt like years and years before and far away. I knew Black Flag was from LA, but it's from like South Bay. So I think when I like local music, you know, I had these high school bands that I guess were, they were interesting, but I then got into, through Brian Rottinger again, and a few friends that ran labels in Santa Clarita. He had a label called Handheld Heart. And then Mike Ott ran a label called Hopscotch and then Sound Virus. Mm-hmm. They were local guys a few years older than me, and you know, they were putting out local and like current bands. So then I found out about shows more, you know.
So who were some of the local kind of current bands that you were into?
I started to see touring bands. I went to the Smell just opened when I was like 15, I think. I went to an opening party through another friend, and like Dub Narcotic played, or, you know, I didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
You know? Mel Banana played. That was not, obviously that's not local, but it was a current touring thing that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, locally, you know, San Diego hardcore, Spock Rock stuff was happening pretty big. I heard The Locust and was like, holy shit, this is crazy music. And knew that was happening here. And then also Sound Virus, I mean, Hopscotch and Handheld Heart were putting out not really local LA bands, but Submission Hold, you know?
Yeah.
They put out Submission Hold 7-inch.
Deathwish Kids, was that on there?
Yeah, Deathwish Kids. So stuff that was kind of happening. I like that Deathwish
Kids. I love that Deathwish Kids. I like it. You know, I think a lot of, there's another band too. I can't remember right after that, put out a 10-inch. I don't think they were called Deathwish Kids on that though.
Was that on the same label?
I think it might be on the same label and it's like super killer.
Fuck, yeah, I don't remember.
Anyway,
I like that. Yeah, and then they got into Mercy Devils. That didn't click, but so that there was that kind of that world, and then through that I found out about these shows happening, the PCH Club and the Pickle Patch, and which was Stevie Aoki's place.
Yeah, I was going to say the Pickle Patch is like a venue that, you know, out of all the DIY spaces, probably obviously because Steve Aoki's massive ascent as a DJ, but like that has become such a storied venue.
It was his apartment.
You know, and it's also funny how like that stuff really is a launching pad for what became almost like the cool, well, did become the cool, like, you know, Death from Above 1979 and like all this stuff that was kind of like weirdly circulating around San Diego and up into sort of Los Angeles area. It's like, it's amazing to see where all these different people went and how big some of those bands got and some of those people got in their respective communities.
Yeah. And I think LA at that time, when I started going to shows in a serious way, when I was probably 16, 17, you didn't really go into LA, like the city, there was really no shows for that kind of music, for any punk or hardcore, emo, whatever, all of that stuff that was kind of happening at the same time. But out on the outskirts, you know, Santa Barbara, I would drive an hour and a half to go see a show at the Living Room or at the Pickle Patch and then drive back home on these really crazy, foggy, tiny roads. I would never do that now. It's fucking insane. Like 2 a.m. yeah. I can't believe, I don't know what I told my parents. I'm sure. or I'd go to San Diego and see a show, or I'd go to Wilmington, Long Beach and go to the PCH Club, which was a really great venue. And then I learned about through those labels and through seeing bands and opening bands. And then I became aware of all these things like Le Choc. Got so many local bands. And then the smell was the smell is where I landed, I think, because, it was closer. It was in North Hollywood when it first opened, and that was only 20 minutes from me. And they were programming much more interesting music for me. It got more experimental and got more free and open.
Like, eventually it becomes like a scene, and there's like, obviously it still goes to this day, and it's very much an active part, but like eventually there becomes like sort of like what is defined, at least by the outside, is like, oh, that's like the smell scene. But in the beginning, was it just kind of like more of like a hodgepodge venue of who was coming in there and playing?
Yeah, I wouldn't say hodgepodge because it felt like the people who opened it, Jim Smith, Jarrett and Ara, those three people. Jim didn't play music, but you go to Jim's house. I went to Jim's house for the first time when I was probably 18 or so, and his records, and he was listening to Albert Eiler and No New York they were definitely into more experimental and free music. And Ara was in that band, Godsick Pink, who were kind of a no-wavy, free jazz-type band. And Jarrett was in this band called the Uphill Gardeners. Everything was sort of open. The smell felt very like they were trying to be sophisticated.
Okay,
I didn't get that then, but there's something about it where there was hardcore venues and punk venues. That's kind of all that played there. And then this was like over the speakers, they'd be playing jazz. And then there'd be someone, playing an experimental set with a guitar or a piece of glass. And you just sort of, it felt like it was happening now or something. Yeah. But there was really no, I think the scene from the smell was a holdover from the Jabberjaw, because the Jabberjaw closed. And then that's why the smell really opened, was to fulfill that space where the Jabberjaw was, which was, I guess, LA indie, much more, maybe had ties to the Northwest,
Did you ever go to the Jabberjaw?
I was just a little too late. Yeah.
I only know from that book. Well, the 7 inches that came out too, but then Brian Ray Turcotte's book that came out a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I attempted to go to the makeup show, which was the last show at the Jabberjaw. I don't know what happened. It was my friends. We were going to go something. I didn't end up going, but my friends did. And that was the last show. So I had just heard about the Jabberjaw maybe a month or weeks before it closed. But then the smell opened up pretty quickly. And I was at the mall in my town. And, I met Ara. He was dating this girl that worked at the mall. And I had a little punk look going on. So I think he just was like, hey, we're opening this venue. You should come. We're having a party. And, and then I found out about that place.
So like, there were like sort of more of like the, capital H hardcore shows that would happen at the smell too, right? Like the infamous Dystopia Riot.
Yeah. So that was a few years later when it moved downtown. Okay. But yeah. So Jim would, that, like, then the early scene, it was this holdover from the Jabberjaw, and it felt like they were really trying to figure out this open music and like experimental nights and things like that. And I think it only lasted in that spot for 2 years, maybe. And then it moved downtown in 2000 or 2001. And Ara and Jarrett, the two founding members, left. So it was just Jim. So Jim was really, he wasn't really programming. He was like allowing other promoters to come in and book stuff. So I started booking stuff there around 2000 or so, 2001. And I brought in a lot of hardcore shows there.
What were some of the shows you booked?
Total Fury.
Yes.
Reagan SS. God damn. Cold Sweat.
So, because that's also kind of like a parallel thing that's happening around, I guess, maybe just before this, but around the same time where, like, you've got like that sort of slap ham scene happening a little bit north of there and those kind of bands as well, right?
Yeah. So those bands were looking for a place to play because the PCH Club closed down. Mm-hmm. That was the venue that I went to when I was younger, and they had a bunch of hardcore shows. So I was sort of a bridge between that. You know, Jim didn't like doing those shows really, unless I was there to vouch for it and be there to help clean up, because he's like, I don't need to do these shows because it's kind of a pain in the ass. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, I want to help these kids out, but the clientele sometimes can be a little aggressive. And, I got a lot of shows through Matt Average. I would work with him, like Life Halt, Felix, Ernie, and those guys, book shows for them. Please Inform the Captain, This Is a Hijack, like Esperanza, that kind of those guys. There was a pretty healthy crew of people booking hardcore shows and stuff like that at the Smell. But I think after a while, before the Dystopia show, I think Jim was sort of trying to phase that stuff out because it just didn't seem worth it for him, I guess, to have to deal with all of the shit that went on post show, like people hanging out in the alley and drinking and, you know, and just kind of destroying the place.
Yeah. Like it felt like it was, you know, going there a few years later and getting there, like there was almost like two punk scenes happening. Well, there's probably tons of punk scenes happening at the same time, but it felt like there was the Smell scene, and that was very much like, you know, musically adventurous and going all these different places. And there was also sort of like a much more kind of like codified, this is the hardcore scene type scene. And they felt like they were almost not really meeting at all, except maybe before I showed up, obviously through the shows that you're doing.
I mean, there's so many different orbits in LA.
Yeah.
You know, I brought a lot of that stuff to the Smell, but I loved the Smell, and I felt, I mean, after a while, I stopped doing those shows too, because it just became the same old kind of bullshit that happens. Like, and I think after booking so many shows like that, for me, at least, it felt less interesting, just being involved. Cause I wasn't really in a hardcore scene when I was younger. Like, I grew up in a weird ass town, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when I found the Smell, it really felt like I was trying to build something. And I think the hardcore stuff I liked, and I was friends with those guys, and I was bringing it in, but it didn't really, I don't know if there was so much of a vested interest in like nurturing the Smells community. It was sort of like, well, we'll book a show anywhere. We just need a place to play. We have like a hardcore scene. So it's like people would kind of come in and maybe not be so interested in what the Smells, the ideological side of the Smell.
Yeah, no, it's, I think you put it perfectly there, where like it's the idea of joining a scene versus like building a scene.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working on building something.
Yeah. And it definitely is like one of the, you know, it was something completely unique, you know, and look at the bands that came out of that and look at the impact that those bands had in different worlds and stuff like that. Like it was really, you know, like a scene was built.
Yeah. Part of me wishes, I don't know, there might was more crossover, I guess, with the other punk scene, but that punk, you know, that hardcore scene had been going, it's like continuing. Mm-hmm. It has been going since the late 80s or something, mm-hmm. You know, like a hardcore thrash music. It's happening. The other side of the Smell stuff was building. So yeah, this thing happening right now. We didn't know what was going on, you know? Mm-hmm.
Coming as an outsider, looking at it, it feels like, you know, it was a place that drew people that were obviously involved in the punk scene, you know, like Bob's been on, like all these people have been on that, you know, were there, but didn't necessarily feel drawn to what was being kind of taken up as being punk rock at that moment and wanted to kind of make space of their own.
Yeah, I think punk rock, and especially living and being from LA, has a really, you know, it's undefinable, because I mean, look at our past lineage of punk music from here. It's like, I mean, Black Flag and X, these bands that were really, or screamers, or bands that at the time were really pushing, I think, what the idea of punk was. So I think if you get into that mindset and try to think about those bands like the Minutemen or something, I mean, you can really sidestep a lot of the punk aping that goes on, I think, in scenes. You just sort of go directly to the source of inspiration and like look for something fresh and new. Cause yeah, like I said, this, I credit Jim and Ara and Jared, cause those guys were friends with older people who were into avant-garde music, you know? And when I started booking shows in 2001 or so, my palette was pretty limited, but it felt exploratory to go into there and like the band I was in, I started with, you know, I wanted to play with this guy, Craig Grady, who I saw there, that was, you know, playing these really kind of like homemade instruments and things, you know.
Mm-hmm. It like also, you know, were there any bands that kind of bridged those gaps, and like, were there any bands that kind of crossed over between the two scenes? Like, would Man Is the Bastard, or Bastard Noise, I guess, would have, right?
Yeah. Bastard Noise. Yeah. And that's a good one to bring up. When I booked a show for Amps for Christ and Bastard Noise together, like, those guys hadn't seen each other in a long time. I didn't really know all the politics of it all, but, yeah. It felt a bit dicey, I guess. I just was like, I love Man's Bastard. I like these things. They should all play together. Yeah. But yeah, Bastard Noise would play, and yeah, the sets would just be pure noise, and it felt like very appropriate at a place like The Smell. Mm-hmm. I don't know where, you know, maybe they could play other punk venues too because of their history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I brought up God Sick Pink. They were a band that were on 5RC. And 5RC actually felt very aligned with kind of the early Smell.
What's 5RC?
So 5RC was a label that was associated with Kill Rock Stars. And they started putting out, like, I think Deerhoof maybe was on 5RC. It seemed like the experimental, like, more fucked up. It was Slim Moon's, like, weird version of Kill Rock Stars.
Okay.
So, he was putting out a lot of kind of, yeah, he put out God Sick Pink, and that was kind of an LA band, and, yeah, you know, they had saxophones and played their instruments upside down, and, you know, had a punk attitude, but
yeah,
were anything but, you know.
Like, would like there be like, you know, like a band like Melt Banana, I guess, would have also crossed over because they were on Slap a Ham and stuff like that too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I saw them there probably two or three times.
Well, we got to talk about the show that lives on in infamy from there, which is this Dystopia show.
Yeah.
I remember first coming there and hearing about it. I think it was like the third time we came to LA, and just like the amount of emotion that was packed into this story that I kept hearing from different people. It seems like it was a real defining show.
Yeah. Well, it was before. Okay. So I don't remember who booked this Dystopia show. I wish I knew who booked it, but they had played there before. It wasn't me. No. And they had played there before, I think. Anyway, so they played there, and it was like the capacity of The Smell is 250. So the Dystopia show was happening, and there was probably 250 people inside, but probably like, felt like 400 people, 500 people outside, like crusty kids that wanted to get into the show. Mm-hmm. The Smell's all volunteer run. So I'm out there. I think me and Randy and a couple other people are out there trying to hold these people, the kids back, you know, like, hey, it's sold out. They're like, fuck, it's not sold out. Like, they're trying to like pry open these big metal doors. And they're like, look, guy, there's still room in there. And we're like, you know, Jim's like, please, you know, we can't let more people in because the fire marshal had already come and said, this is your, this, you, it's 250. That's your capacity. Yeah. If we come by, there's more people in there. And also just people in the alley, you know, people are trying to drive through and it's just like a whole thing. And people are throwing bottles and getting all pissed off. So Dystopia starts playing. People are trying to tear these doors down. Me and a few other people are trying to do security. And at one point, this crowd of people like crowd surfs these like two crusty guys over our head. And they like get in and like shimmy their way in the door and they kick it open. And they're just like, fuck yeah. And then all these kids rush in and we're just, at that point, you know, at that point, we're just, our hands are up. We're like, ah. Kind of laughing, just like, all right, fuck it, you guys got in. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
And just all these people stormed in, saw this wild show. And now that felt like a defining moment, like, fuck, you know, we don't have control and we don't know what's going to happen. And then weeks later, this band, The Whip, played.
I don't know that. I don't think.
The Whip, yeah, it was the drummer from Carp.
Okay, yeah.
And Jarrett from Carp. And they put out a 7-inch. It's really great. But the drummer for Carp died shortly after that. Mm-hmm. But they played, and the fire marshal came when they played and said, maybe they had heard about the Dystopia show. I think that's what the story was. There was a lot of people converging in this space and this alley. They came. It might have been a day or two after the Dystopia show. And they shut the smell down. The smell was closed down for months and months because they had to get fire doors. They had to get exit signs. They had to have a handicap accessible bathroom. They had to do all of these things. And so that was a big bummer for us because that was right when our kind of scene was happening there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a kind of a thorn. But a lot of the shows moved to the house I was living at, actually. So I had all these kind of wild shows in this fucked up kind of squat that we made.
You know, your house has come up on this show actually a few times now.
Has it? Wow. God,
yeah. Yeah. Beth talked about crowd surfing through your kitchen, drinking a beer.
Yeah. It was a really, I was a bike messenger. I met these guys. I didn't have a place to live. And I was working and these guys like, hey, we found this spot. It's really cheap. It's like $300. You can have a room. I was like, $300? That's way too much money. So I split my room with this other bike messenger guy. So I paid $150. I had like a curtain up. But as soon as I went in there, they got in a fight with the landlord and they're like, we're not paying rent anymore. So fuck it. Don't even worry about it. So we lived there for a year and we paid no rent and we had, I started booking shows. They didn't have shows before that, but I started booking shows there because there's kind of a big room. It's a huge place. It was in Hollywood. It was above a furniture store, like, I mean, multiple rooms. I started booking some shows there, and then the smell closed down. We moved a bunch of these shows, this fucked up house. And I remember the funny story is we booked a hella Joan of Arc show. And like, that's like shit that would happen to smell, and they go to this fucked up house, you know. And I remember Tim Kinsella, Joan of Arc guys pulled up in front of our house and they were supposed to play The Smell, you know. They booked The Smell.
Yeah.
They show up and I'm like, hey, how you doing? Here's the venue. And Tim Kinsella kind of looks and he goes, fuck. And he like sent another guy up, one of the other guys in the band, to like check it out. And I show him the place. And then the guy comes down. He's like, all right, Tim, yeah, I think it'll be fine. It's cool. Cause I think they were just ready to bounce.
Yeah.
They're like, we're going to play this like kid's house. Like, fuck this, dude. Come on. But it was actually a really great, really great show.
Yeah. No, I think, and once you're in a band, like at the time, if a band rolled up and did that shit, I would have been so pissed and so bummed.
Right. I know, like weeks and weeks on tour, you're like, we're supposed to play a cool venue and play a house. It's like, come on, man.
But then like, yeah, once you're in the band, you can kind of see it from the band's perspective. But like as a kid, you'd be like, what the fuck, dude? Just play,
yeah, come
man.
On. I know. It's so cool. They'd be like, there's no backstage. Come on. What are you going to do?
Where are we going to put our shit? We got to
play. I mean, it was really fun. Like, the house was really gnarly. It was like spray painted all over. And then that last, Beth was probably talking about that last party we had where basically trashed the place because the guy, the cops came and said, you guys have to leave in, you know, 48 hours. So we had a show, some people played, and then people just like destroyed this poor building. I think I remember there was also talks of Jim. I think the smell is right after the remodeling of the smell didn't happen yet. And there was talks of maybe trying to put in a stove or a kitchen because maybe there was a permit thing that could happen. So maybe the smell could be more of a cafe.
Yeah.
And there was a big hood. There was like an industrial hood at this place I lived at. And Jim's like, can I have that? Like, yeah. So I remember him like climbing and trying to like take this hood down. But like, I don't think they ever got it because they didn't have the proper tools. But
yeah. And that would have been a pretty gnarly kitchen.
Yeah, dude. The place was fucking, it was really wild. And there was two wings. There was me and these bike messenger guys. And there's a whole other wing with this kind of, I don't remember this dude, this like junkie kind of kid that would come out every once in a while. You know, there were needles in the bathroom. It was a pretty gnarly zone. Every once in a while, like Jesse from, he was an MTV VJ.
Oh yeah. Jesse. Fuck. What's that dude?
The tall, lanky guy.
Jesse Camp.
Yeah. Right. Tall, long hair. Hey, kind of had a interesting way of speaking. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would always show up at the house. Maybe he was, I don't know what his situation was, but I'd kind of come out, go to the bathroom and be like, hey, and he'd kind of be walking around. Like, that's the guy, Jesse from the VJ from Spring Break. What's that guy doing here? That's Hollywood for you, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's the thing about when you, especially that time going there, it's just like, it felt like a city that was just before all the developers moved in and crushed the downtown type thing. And then also there was like this weird, super high glamour thing that's also happening right close by. So coming from Canada, it felt very exciting.
Yeah. God damn, dude. Yeah, I'm sure. It felt exciting for me. I mean, you know, I think just living different places in Hollywood and like I said, my mom grew up in Hollywood, but where I grew up was 30 minutes north and it was kind of a cow town. Where Infest were from, you know, Saugus.
They're from, that's right, because also we haven't talked about this yet, Chopping Block.
Oh, yeah, Dave Keck's band. So yeah, we should probably get into this, huh?
Yeah, if you want to, because believe me, I'm still very into this band and stuff, so let's... go on.
No, right, when I was in high school, well, I knew who Dave Keck was. My father used to be a chiropractor. Mm-hmm. He was a chiropractor, and one of his patients was this guy, Dave Keck. So I knew him when I was younger. So when I'm in high school, ninth grade or so, I'm getting into punk. Dave Keck, hey, what's up? You're Dr. Spunt's son. Like, hey, man, and he sold me or gave me the Chopping Block 7-inch.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I later, you know, a few years later learned, yeah, he helped start Infest, and that whole crew was from Saugus, my high school, and I had no idea, but Chopping Block, Dave's an interesting cat, you know, he was hanging around with kids at our high school, I think with seniors and stuff, those bands I went and saw at the Natural Fudge Cafe, Dave was also working on another band with some kids from my high school, Oh, and Dave was also in a band that I saw in my town called Teen Creeps, which I named a song after.
Go on. That's where that song title comes from?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I just named it after his band because I thought it was a good name. I don't know. And I heard they have a recording somewhere. I should probably ask Dave, but I don't remember it, like what it sounded like at all, but I just remember visually it looked cool because Dave, you know, Dave was an older guy and he didn't care how he looked, like wasn't trying to be hip.
Yeah.
He wore sweatpants, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was these two other kind of younger kids from my high school that were, you know, one guy looked like Rollins, like shaved head, flag era, real tall. And this other guy was kind of jockey. I don't really remember much, but I just remember thinking, I remember, you know, like, I feel like a year later, I almost thought like that was my favorite band, even though I had heard nothing. I saw like a glimpse of them playing, but they just seemed cool. But that name stuck with me. I think they have a recording. I should ask. But I haven't been in touch with Dave in a while, but
what was your first band called?
The first band I was in was called The Grommets.
And what did it sound like?
It sounded like, you know, like that song Forming from the Germs, like na 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 na, like every song was that, cuz no one knew how to do it. I sang and yeah, it's FYP, I guess, or like nothing. Yeah, two chord punk music. So it was like me and all these other kids, two other kids, and then the drummer was the senior. He was older, and I think he might have just thought it was funny that he's playing with little guys. But yeah, we had a song. I mean, I was a lyricist, so I had a song called "The Riverdales Suck" because I was in the Screeching Weasel, and the Riverdales were the band after. And I think the lyrics were like, "The Riverdales suck, you know, the Riverdales suck, the Riverdales suck. Say it ain't so, Ben. Say it ain't so, Ben Weasel." Yeah. And then we had a song called "I Don't Know," where you just kind of yelled that over and over.
Do you know Tony Molina? You know that dude?
The name, yeah. What was he?
He played in Ovens, and now he does Tony Molina as his side project. He says the Riverdales are better than Screeching Weasel.
I haven't listened to Riverdales in a long time, but at the time, I was just—I think I was sad that they broke up, and I never got to see him play.
I'm Team Dean on this one. You know, I think Tony right? was wrong. Come on. You know,
I think so. I mean, the Screeching Weasel is still something I can listen to. It's nostalgic, but you know that. Power pop punk from that era. It's pretty great.
Oh God. Yeah. Like there's some of those bands where you're just like, you listen to it, you're like, yeah, this person could write a song, you know, obviously this is where they're playing, but like they could probably write a song in any genre they wound up in.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
You going back to that, was there any sort of holdover of that early Infest Power Violence scene where like kids kind of waving that flag at that point, other than I guess Teen Creeps?
Not really till later. I mean, I knew Dave on like more of a personal level, and I actually showed him. I was before I was in Wives with Randy. I was in this band called The Jews, and it was like a very like Smell era 2001. Felt like an avant-garde hardcore band.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, Glenn Branca hardcore. I showed him a tape, and he was like, "This is fucking sick, dude." You know, it was just funny because at that point I was like, "Dude, Dave, you're an Infest man. And that's cool." Yeah, I think late, you know, not in the world I was immediately in, but you know, for the hardcore shows I was booking at, like, I started seeing Infest shirts, and I think for me, I hadn't really come across that in like my orbit. You know, I felt like once I reached outside of this greater hardcore world that I was peripherally in, where I was helping book shows and would see shows, I started seeing like the patches and the shirts would, there would just see more and more of them. And then Infest became, I think, more of a legendary band. You know, there's a story behind them and everything. And Chopping Block, I'm still blown away. You know what that is, but.
Well, I think I only knew about it because it became like a legendary record when it came out. And then it was kind of like this whispered about record amongst record collectors. It's like, oh, this is like, the band that, you know, it was always like, this was the band that taught Infest how to play, or this is the band that inspired Infest. It was always like pitched like that. And then it was actually some guy in from Toronto, Ted Wong, was moving to China and was like selling off all his records, and he had a copy of this record, and it actually had a letter from Dave in the 7-inch. And so that's how I knew all these things about this band, and I became like kind of obsessed with it. So when we were talking, I don't even remember how it came up when we first started talking, and then it turned out you knew it, and it was just like, it blew my fucking mind.
Yeah, that 7-inch, I mean, it was cool. But yeah, I mean, when I think I was 13 or so. I mean, way, it was a little too gnarly for me at that time. Oh, and yeah. I had listened to metal, you know, I'd been to like Napalm Death before that, but I don't know why something about this felt like more gnarly, maybe because it was local and the guy, you know, just coming in with sweatpants in my high school, selling me this thing. Like, and I knew him, and it just felt like weird. Totally bizarre.
Well, it's like we were describing that tape. It looks kind of sketchy in a weird way.
Yeah. And yeah. You're not sure. I mean, the cover is Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A blown out Texas Chainsaw Massacre image, and the font's weird. And it's like, it and also sonically, it kind of like, even makes Infest sound like a Blink-182 type band by comparison. Like, it's like somehow raw, you know?
It's gnarly. There is double bass pedal, drum pedal on there. And there's some more, it has more of a metal leaning than Infest. And I think all the sound bites, you know, there's like, what's the one with the
Taxi Driver? Is there a Taxi Driver one in it?
I think it's like Story of O. It's like, it's kind of pervy. Yeah, and then I think, and then it's, Braveheart? I think there's Braveheart in there. It's, you know, but it does these brutal songs. I mean, it has that, it has the Infest vibe. But yeah, you know, I think there wasn't, I think in that hardcore world, yeah, Infest, and they've still continued to become a legendary band. And actually, I didn't see them play in this last, their kind of revival. I haven't been into a lot of those, I just can't bring myself to do a lot of that, but I'm sure it was good.
They're on my list of bands that I have to see one day. You know, Spencer from Trash Talk now plays in the band too.
Ah. There you go.
So it's
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always wanted to see them. They've definitely been on my, my want to see list, but you know, a Chopping Block reunion would also be amazing to see. So
dude, fuck. Dave might be down with that.
So what was your first band that played live?
The Grommets.
Oh, you guys played live with that.
Yeah. So I was, 13 years old. We started this band and simultaneously, okay, that, remember I told you the first band I saw was at this VFW hall. They were called The Outside. I think they were a pop punk band.
Yeah.
I somehow got in touch with that guy, and he told me he was going to book shows at this this place there that was called Nicole's Teen Dance Club, and it was opening up, and they were going to do I guess an underage club for younger kids or something. So he's like, I might be able to book some shows here. And I told him I was in this band. I mean, he got us a show at this place that was 5 minutes from my house. It was in a strip mall. And what's crazy, there must have been like 100 or 150 kids at this show. My first show I ever played.
That's,
but because
fucking wild.
It was a small town, but like everyone wanted to come to the show. If I think about how funny it is now, like before we ever recorded anything, we had some crappy boombox tape that I lost. But we had t-shirts because my mom ran a silkscreen shop. So I made Grommet t-shirts and like sold them at my high school, you know, which is funny. Like, I think about No Age, we actually had shirts before we had anything recorded too. I think the silkscreen shop has been instrumental in that, but
yeah,
yeah,
no,
like, I'm just selling these shirts, $5 to these kids. And then we play the show and kids were wearing these Grommet shirts. And it's like, manufactured or something.
But you know, No Age always had, you know, and still has like the sickest merch, right? Like, so I guess that started really early on with the Grommets.
Yeah, I think I had access to the silkscreen shop, so I could go in there and just do whatever. And I mean, my mom designed the Grommets shirt actually, because I just typed Grommets in a typewriter font, and my mom was like, well, you know, if you crumple it up and then re-photocopy it. This is my mom. You crumple it up, re-photocopy it. It'll have these sort of cracked lines in it. Like, okay, cool. So we did that to Grommets in the back. And actually the front of it, that said Grommets in the back. The front was something that I got off a message board, early message board, or internet message board, of like a skinhead kid with a baseball bat. Like someone had drawn, and I somehow downloaded it or printed it. I can't even remember, but that was in the front of the shirt. Like someone else's design, you know?
Sounds like a pretty hard looking shirt though. I wish
I had the artwork still. I know. I got to find it. My mom, they actually might, I don't know if they threw a lot of stuff away. They might still have it.
So after the Grommets, did you immediately go into the other band you were describing? Like, or was there a band in between?
Oh no. So that was, I was like a ninth grader. And then by the time I was 15, I was in a band that was a bit more, I guess, hardcore, straight edge, you know, I think we're a straight edge band, I guess, but not like, we're also pretty, like I said, we grew up in kind of a farmy town. Mm-hmm. As much as we knew about straight edge, or at least I probably knew more because I knew some bands, but the other guys were like, maybe not as hip to what it was. We were playing a kind of punk hardcore kind of music.
What kind of bands were you, you know, taking inspiration from for that?
I mean, everywhere from like the first Bad Religion album to, maybe I got, I think around that time I might've gotten a Strife record. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
I mean, it ran the gamut. This is very like suburban high school. But yeah, I was like, I was playing guitar. I was kind of palm muting some stuff, you know, I was playing group fast, but the drummer guy, I don't think was really into punk. He was into the Deftones and stuff like that. So it was like a challenge to try to figure out how to like, I don't like that, like, China symbol, like that's not really this, you know, trying to show him stuff, but he's like a stoner dude into Korn and the Deftones. It was a real fucked up band, but you know, in my mind it was like, yeah, I like Minor Threat and like want to do something like this. And then the singer guy is still a friend of mine. He liked the Clash and, you know, and Bad Religion.
It sounds like it would have sounded like one of those late 80s kind of hardcore bands from Southern California.
Yeah, totally. Like that, those the double bass drums. And then I think we started getting into, you know, a little bit more of like melodic, you know, like emo-y kind of tones. And mm-hmm. yeah, that band played for, I don't know, a few months.
Did it record at all?
I think we just recorded it, you know, like a boombox tape.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, I mean,
I got to hear it, Dean. I got to hear it.
I don't know if I think actually I lost the tape.
Oh, sure.
I think the singer kid, my friend Travis, I remember actually I did lose it because I'm like, hey, can I borrow that? And he's like, look, it's the only copy we have. Don't lose it. I'm like, I'm not going to lose it. I'm in a horrible archivist. You know, we've talked about this before. I'm not really a record collector. You know, I don't need things to be archived perfectly. I just sort of I like the happenstance nature of finding things and like stumbling and losing. Like I kind of go through life like that a bit.
Yeah.
Allow things to happen.
You still hold on to all that stuff though. You still have that Chopping Block 7-inch.
Yeah.
See, there you go. You're a collector.
There's some stuff I can't get rid of. You know, I did sell a bunch of records recently, but you know from being in a band yep. and stuff throughout the years, you get records. Yep. Like I've had records for 10 years I never opened. You know, I got rid of those kind of records where I'm like, some label sent me a box of records that I'd have no use for.
You got to keep the Chopping Block and you got to keep the Fire Party.
Yeah, Fire Party's gonna be. I'm gonna throw that on right now and see if it. those are the records that like. Yeah, one day I know I'm going to come to you. Well, I got Beefeater. That took a while, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I got like that finally clicked.
I'm waiting to still get Fugazi myself. So you
know. That's funny.
So did that band? Was that? No, I guess like you would have done probably another band before you started doing your stuff with the Smell, or was that kind of like the band that directly preceded the band that preceded Wives?
Yeah, there was some intern. I mean, not just kind of jamming at that point. Yeah, the first band that I was in that really played was the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
We started playing at the Smell, and that was like I'd already moved out. I was into punk music, and I think these older guys, Jarrett, who helped start the Smell, and Jeff, those guys ended up being a band called the Young People. Did you ever hear that mm-hmm. indie rock band?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and. Jeff had just moved to LA from Providence where he went to art school. He was in Landed and the thing called Pink and Brown and like that world, Black Dice, that kind of era mm-hmm. bands. And I was into that stuff. And the singer was this guy, Anthony Berryman, who I ended up putting out a record for him in this band called So Damn Insane on my label.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a hardcore band, but yeah, I wasn't, you know, I was loosely getting into more kind of experimental stuff. Those guys, a few years older, they kind of helped me. They gave me records and like, you should check this out and check this out. This is cool. And that band, yeah, that band was sort of I was going into it that it was like a hardcore band. I think like Void. I think that's what they were referencing. Maybe I had a Void. I feel like I had like a spray painted Void logo on my t-shirt at some point. And they picked up on that, but then the band ended up being way more fucked. Like, I think because of the guys I was playing with, they wanted to play, you know, they'd like this show we play was, we have a clock and it was like, we play one note for 4 minutes and then change when the clock, you know, would strike a certain number to one other tone, and then it got real, real heady.
Was it fast too?
Kind of. Yeah, there were some fast parts, and there was some. There's a video somewhere. I'll dig it out. I'll show you.
You said you recorded a tape, right? Was that the only thing you recorded?
Yeah, I think there's one song, and I think a demo tape. The one song I gotta find these things.
Yeah,
they were cool. I mean, it was cool because it really felt like, maybe because I was younger, but it felt very cool to be playing, to be experimenting with these guys. And you know, people would come to our shows, and I think Load Records said they were going to put out a record, and then we stopped playing together. I think that's what happened. I can't really remember. And then the Wives started, and the Wives sort of took all my time, my energy.
So
I mean, young people started, and Wives started simultaneously. And I think those guys did their thing, and we were doing our thing.
So. You mentioned earlier, there was like, you know, like during that Dystopia show, there was a sense of like losing control from like the scene that you guys kind of, or I guess like what you guys, you know, your space, losing control of the space. Like, was there a moment where you felt like your scene was kind of coming together there or coalescing there? Like, you know, and I mean like yourselves, Miko Miko and Abe Vigoda and all those bands that would kind of like come out later on. But like, is there a moment where you think like, you know, almost the younger people, the next generation kind of with Jim obviously took over that space?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it really happened with Miko Miko. Cause I think why we were cementing, I mean, I was very clear in my dedication to the smell and wanted it to be our space. Mm-hmm. Cause I saw the potential in that, the people and the place. I just felt like perfect. So we were playing there a lot. And then I met the girls from Miko Miko. The second Wives show. Yeah. We played this like anarchist sort of info shop that was in LA too. And I remember meeting Jenna there, and we played, you know, we were playing the Wives. We were a bit confrontational. I think just, it was our nature. So we played this benefit, like, you know, crust punk, everyone's wearing black. So we, it's obnoxious. We like all wore like pink. We, yeah. You know, our band was kind of odd, but yeah, I met her there, and she was the only one who came up to me and was like, that was cool. She must have been 16 or something.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a cool set. So then I ran into them maybe a, you know, months later, and they were still in a band called the Dead Banana Ladies, which was a kind of a crusty punk band.
That's an awesome name.
Yeah. They have recordings.
Oh, I got to hear that. I definitely got to hear that.
That's, I got to send it to you. That is much more like, wow, they're trying to do like crust, you know? So they were still in that when I met them. And I think I never saw them play. I was going to see a show. Like, I started dating Jennifer a little bit after that, but she's like, oh, that band broke up. We're in this new band called Miko Miko. Cool. Saw them play, and they played my house that we were talking about. There must have been their second or third show or something. Wives might have played that show too. And Jim was there from The Smell, and he saw them play and invited them to play The Smell. And that felt like, that was huge, because I think they brought in a whole different element of younger kids, and they were, you know, they were into punk, 77 punk music. That was kind of what they were referencing. Mm-hmm. But I think just their energy was really amazing for everyone here, because they could give two shits about any sort of anything. It felt like they were not LA. They were just playing. They were super, they're just very cool. And I think there, you know, people would see them, and then younger kids started playing more. And I think because I was booking shows there a lot, I was just booking these younger kids, and we'd be playing together. And I felt very inspired by all these younger kids and Wives. And yes, and that sort of was the building of that world. And I think the older guys, like the guys I was playing with in the Jews, I feel like they probably felt maybe pushed out or felt not that interested in this kind of younger music, maybe. Mm-hmm. I got that sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to you forever, and it's been amazing to catch up, and I could talk to you for way longer. Would you come back for a part two at some point, Dean?
Yeah. Fuck yeah, man. Yeah, I know. I should probably go.
Well, before I let you go, I just wanted to find out, like, quickly, like, what was it like at that moment where, you know, like, everyone was like, oh, The Smell's the next Seattle, or The Smell's the next Gilman, or, like, where it became like, you know, and it was sort of, I talked about it with Randy a little bit, but that's like the last vestige of almost like a scene being discovered by like indie rock media, or not discovered, but like, yeah, you know, feasted upon by indie rock media.
Yeah. It was tough. I think because as that was happening, we weren't able to be at the Smell, and we were touring a lot. Mm-hmm. We were traveling, and almost like we were promoting the Smell in a way, but not like unintentionally. Well, intentionally trying to talk about it because we believed that it was a great space and everything. But I don't know. You know, I felt like almost like we abandoned that our ship, because there was a lot of attention, and we weren't really able to help focus that, guide that attention to where it needed to be, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's hard as an insider, I think, to see it, but it did feel like everywhere we'd go, it was talking about the Smell. And then it became at a certain point, like, I don't even know what the Smell is, you know, because it's not a genre. There's no thing that came. It's just like just vibes, you know, vibes and feelings and an attitude that was coming out of there. I'm kind of at a loss. I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly, because I feel like there was a big LA Weekly or LA Times article that came out that was like, can the Smell survive this sort of popularity? And I feel like I felt maybe, I remember reading that and feeling like my voice wasn't really heard, because I feel like maybe it was taken out of context, or we weren't really able to be there to see what was really happening. We're sort of experiencing it from far away, and yeah.
But it's such an amazing, you know, it's like, I think part of the reason I'm so fascinated by that scene is the fact that it's like one of the last geographical kind of scenes. Like, now it's everything's sort of much more decentralized. It feels like when things start happening, people are, you know, obviously, you know, in different parts of the world or different parts of the country or multiple countries, and kind of coming together. And it felt like the Smell was like the last time where there was like, oh, this is this venue and there's all these bands and they all sound different. And it's amazing too. And I think the thing about it is like, it did survive, and you guys survived, and Miko Miko, like, obviously didn't survive as Miko Miko, but like, you know, various people went on to do other projects out of that, and like Abe Vigoda and like Best Coast, and you know, like it's like everyone kind of, like, obviously everyone had their ups and downs, but like everything kind of came out okay. Like, it did survive. Like, that write that editor a letter and be like, yeah, fuck it, it survived.
Yeah, but you know, I feel like it also, you know, with you guys too. I mean, I feel like we were definitely part of the Smell world, but we were also part of this other sort of, I don't know, indie punk happening with you guys and us, and like Pitchfork blowing up stuff that necessarily didn't ask for it, you know, or didn't even like, it just sort of, they picked up on a thing that was happening, like, oh, hey, indie rock, like punk is happening in indie rock or whatever that was. It felt like, that was also part of our that was focused upon us too. So I think that's what I mean. I feel like the Smell became, I felt like we were no longer just part of this scene. So there's a bunch of attention, but it was like, fuck, dude, we're also like in Tokyo playing, and we're playing festivals now. It's hard. And the Smell has survived, and it's a totally different thing now, you know? And as it should be, young kids do their thing. And, I don't know. It's a lot to unpack, and I haven't had any like, critical talks about it. You should get into it further, I guess, at some point.
That's a part two thing. But, oh, it's funny that you brought that up, that whole moment where it was like yourselves and us and Jay Riotar was kind of blowing up, and like Deer Hunter. It was like all these people that were kind of like from completely different places, but all kind of like wanting to approach this thing with the same sort of attitude of like being punk kids, but wanting to do something different, maybe.
Yeah. Does that name have a scene? You would know.
Is that, I don't know. Yet? I guess like disparagingly, you could refer to it as hipster hardcore, but I would.
Oh, fuck you. Oh, no.
But I don't know. No, I think, I don't know like what that scene would be called. Like, I honestly look at it as being like the last No, I don't think last, because there's still, it's still happening today. But like one of those moments where all of a sudden, like, punk rock boils to the surface again, you know, and like,
yeah,
you get like a lot of stuff kind of coming out of it, you know, and it just, and then it dies down again, and then it kind of happens. And it seems like it happens every sort of like 10 years. And I'm just glad that we got to ride that wave.
Yeah, that was fun, man. And I, whenever it comes, you know, let me know when it has a name. I feel like you're going to be the first to know. You're more plugged into pop culture than I am.
Well, when you come back, we'll have to figure out what that name is.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do a part two, man. I think that'd be really, there's a lot more to talk about.
Thank you, Dean, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Dean's going to come back for a part two. We got more to talk about. We could probably talk about Chopping Block for another hour. You know, that's how I love that 7-inch so much. It's on YouTube. You can find that on YouTube. Check it out. It is definitely, you know, if there's like a Kill by Death for that era, that would certainly have to be on one of the first rounds of it. Kill by Power Violence, I guess, right? That's it. All right. Next week on the show, one of my favorite punk bands from Chicago, my favorite scenes ever, a band that I collect obsessively, someone that my brother and I, you know, talked about having on the show for a long time, and now it's finally happened. Next week on the show, from the Bow Weevils, from Lando's 45, Daryl Wilson will be on the show. And my gosh, we go deep about, you know, I've seen him, I'm kind of obsessed with, you know, I've talked about it before on the show. I think the 90s Chicago scene might be in the contenders for the one of the best all-time punk scenes as far as like putting out bands. And anyway, we go into all this next week. That's it for me, everyone. I guess once again, go out there and make your own culture, sign your organ donor cards, fight fascism, stand up for what you fucking believe in right now. Support to everyone that's doing that. Black Lives Matter. Go out and get yourself educated. Read. You know, just learn and listen and take part, donate, show up, do what you can, do what you're able to. And that's it for me on the show. Go out there and be safe too. And I will see you next week. Wear a mask. Holy geez. If you read right now about what happens if you wear a mask, you know, it's very important that we all wear masks, I think, you know, and that's, I don't care if it's against your personal freedom, just wear a fucking mask. Also, they look kind of cool and badass. Like I've gone to Japan, seeing people in masks over the years, you know, not to make light of a very serious situation, of course, but, yeah, I got a cool mask. Wear a mask. And that's it. See you next week on the show. Stay safe, not to lecture anyone. You know, I know everyone probably knows more about all this stuff than I do. So anyway, bye everyone. Love you.